coming up on today's program. An ailing industry, indigenous affairs, and interrupted healthcare. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. Lots of great stuff coming your way in the next half hour, starting with 50 years of unity through diversity. That's the theme for this year's A World Affair, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary. Event organizers say the International Festival celebrates our shared humanity through music, dance, food, and friendship. Wendy Middleton is the secretary of the Dayton International Festival, which is the parent organization that produces it. She told WISO's Mike Frazier why people should come to the event.
It's the best way to eat and drink your way around the world for 3 days and experience some cultures that are local right here in Dayton without any travel necessary. The Miami Valley is very lucky to have such a rich and diverse population from a variety of cultures and countries and ethnic communities from around the world, and they all call the Miami Valley home.
What was the catalyst for A World Affair 50-odd years ago before the first one?
It started at the University of Dayton, and there was a professor who had a number of international students in his programs, and he decided to, toward the end of the school year, put together a festival where they could all celebrate their individual cultures and share food and ethnic dress and music. And it was just a community, small community celebration among students, and it grew from there.
When will it be held and where?
Festival dates are May 1st through 3rd, and we are open starting Friday at 5 p.m., and the hours vary throughout the weekend, but we wrap up on Sunday at 6 p.m., and we're out at the Greene County Expo Center in Xenia.
Are there tickets, and how much are tickets?
There are tickets available online now for pre-sale. The pre-sale price right now is $9 for adults and $6 for seniors and children. Ages 5 and under are free. Military members, the pre-sale price is good for them throughout the entire festival weekend.
Do you think the Dayton World Affair has more significance in the current political or social climate than perhaps in years past?
I think it does. I think it's important for everyone to come together as a community and show that we are stronger when we stand together, and that what unites us is stronger with our diversity. Our cultural theme this year is 50 years of unity through diversity, and we feel very strongly that we only make each other better by learning about each other's cultures and how things are done differently, and how things are very similar between us. And we think that it's important for our community to experience that now more than ever.
What does a World Affair mean to you?
A World Affair to me means, especially as a parent now, I get to take my children around the world, so to speak, in a weekend and teach them about the ways other cultures look at the same things that we look at. And it gives them an opportunity to grow in those areas without having to actually get on a plane and travel the world. And I get to pass that on to them. And it makes me excited to see other families exploring the cultural displays around the festival and trying foods that they've never tried. And people always find something that they're surprised about and excited to learn about. And that is, that makes my heart sing.
So it sounds like you would obviously encourage parents to bring their kids to this festival.
Absolutely. And the little ones love the children's passport that they get when they walk in the door. They like going to the different countries and getting stamps on their passports. And we have an interactive stage with traditional music and dance, and the countries have audience participation and will teach those dances, or, you know, let the kids bang on the taiko drums and things like that. And it's a lot of fun. We run two stages of entertainment throughout the entire festival, and we're excited to welcome some guest performers this year. We're going to have Father, Son, and Friends come out and play with us, The Squad, which is a local reggae band. We have Gori Drum and Dance Company coming to perform at the festival from Columbus, and All Act Chinese Dragons are making another performance at the festival this year as well.
So it's music, food, and dancing. Sounds like a good time.
It's a great time.
Wendy Middleton with Dayton International Festival, speaking with WISO's Mike Frazier. And a note that the Dayton International Festival is a financial supporter of WISO. Up next on our program, today from the Ohio Newsroom.
Support comes from Ohio CASA. CASA volunteers are everyday Ohioans who advocate for thousands of children experiencing abuse or neglect, giving them a voice in court. Learn more at ohiocasa.org.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom takes you around the state, connecting you with news and neighbors from all over Ohio. I'm Claire Roth. The newspaper industry is struggling. Ohio lost more than half of its daily and weekly news publications between 2005 and 2025. That's according to data from the Local News Initiative. But one community newspaper in Ohio is growing. The Ohio Newsroom's Kendall Crawford takes us to Sugar Creek.
Every week, Milo Miller is in charge of publishing a paper. But instead of relying on a newsroom full of beat reporters and columnists, his paper, The Budget, looks to handwritten letters from across the country.
Millersburg, Ohio, Rexford, Montana, Tuscola, Illinois.
The Budget was founded in 1890 by John C. Miller, an Amish Mennonite who wrote a column about what was happening in Sugar Creek's community. He printed it and mailed it to family around the U.S. who wrote back. He decided to publish those letters, too.
Then all these letters started coming in, and by the end of that first year, there was over 100 scribes, so writers, from 12 different states.
It quickly became a national publication, and more than 100 years later, it's sticking to that 19th century model. Each Wednesday, they publish around 70 pages of letters from Amish communities who still rely on print and old-school word of mouth to share their news.
SEP season is almost over. Church was at Levi D. Schlabel's today.
Today, the Budget has around 1,200 scribes who document their daily lives through letters sent to Ohio.
Set to be at John A. Yoder's in a week.
For the past 4 years, Budget staff member Brenda Keller has taken these reports on crops, births, and deaths and transcribed them from sweeping cursive into bold typeface that's distributed as far as Washington. Keller says the letter she's typing up right now is pretty typical of what she's seen over her tenure.
Yeah, they're just going to visit people and having church.
The norm.
That's the norm.
Unlike a traditional publication, there's little editorial oversight. Miller and his staff do some light copy editing, and they remove anything political or controversial. No debates over church rules, no endorsements of one sect over another. But mostly, Miller prints the news just as it comes in. Funny hunting stories, weather gripes, and all.
So a lot of cases, I mean, we're their form of entertainment. We're their nightly news. You know, that's what they're opening up. You know, they're not turning on the television or going to YouTube or going on TikTok or whatever to figure out what's trending, what's going on, what's happening in the world. A lot of cases, they're reading it in the Budget.
The Amish and Anabaptist aversion to modern technology has kept the Budget circulation steady for years. It has 20,000 paid subscribers, and Miller expects that to grow with the Amish population, which approximately doubles every two decades.
Our struggles are not on the financial end. It's the distribution model, you know, with the United States Postal Service. Presses are becoming fewer and fewer. We're driving 7 hours away to print.
Even with the drive, Miller will keep the Budget an internet-free publication. While he may use a computer, the Budget's audience doesn't. And ultimately,
it's their newspaper. We're just privileged enough to publish it for them.
For the Ohio Newsroom, I'm Kendall Crawford in Sugar Creek.
Support comes from the James at Ohio State. Cancer. For some, it's one of life's fiercest foes. But not at the James, where a team of nearly 300 specialists and over 1,500 researchers are working together to create a cancer-free world.
That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you next week.
You can find more reporting from the Ohio Newsroom on our website at wiso.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. Thanks again for joining us. Whether you're listening on air or to the podcast, up next, a federal small business program that's helped American Indian and Alaska Native tribal firms land lucrative defense contracts has come under scrutiny. That includes firms providing mission-critical services to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We spoke with WISO's Indigenous Affairs reporter, Adriana Martinez-Smiley, about what they've learned. Adriana, welcome.
Thank you, Jerry, for letting me speak about this.
What is the 8A program, and why is the Pentagon planning to review it?
The 8A Business Development Program is a part of the Small Business Administration, and it's intended to help small businesses owned and controlled by socially and economically disadvantaged individuals or groups compete for and receive government contracts. In a video that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth posted to the social media platform X in January, he says the program has morphed into race-based contracting and that there's fraud.
We have no room in our budget for wasteful DEI contracts that don't help us win wars, period, full stop.
Referring to the executive orders from the White House, the Pentagon says it's doing a line-by-line review of contracts awarded to these firms. So far, that's looked like several data calls and audits. These businesses might need to prove community benefits and their eligibility, such as proving that they're economically or socially disadvantaged. Up to this point, many firms have been penalized for missing deadlines for responding to those queries.
I understand you zeroed in on the impact this would have on American Indian and Alaska Native participation in the program. Mm-hmm. What have you found out?
What a lot of tribal communities are concerned about is that their participation in this program has less to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion, and more to do with U.S. treaty and trust obligations to tribal and Alaska Native communities. So I spoke with an attorney from Alaska, Christopher Slotty, who works very closely with these firms.
When Congress acts to provide advantages or potential benefits or opportunities to Native-owned entities, it's doing so not on any type of racial classification. Rather, it's doing so as a political classification based on and exercising Congress's authority under the Indian Commerce Clause.
Now, the reason that this matters in our region is because we have Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, an extremely mission-critical military installation. You know, it has the Air Force Research Laboratory, the headquarters for Air Force Material Command, the National Air and Space Intelligence Center, so a lot of contractors are coming out to this area. Over 800 Air Force contracts have been awarded in Ohio to Alaska Native, American Indian, and tribal firms since 2017. While many contracts are won through open competition, meaning that they aren't through the 8A program, Carol says a majority of federal awards to Native contractors do come from the 8A program.
So how important is federal contracting to tribal governments?
It's extremely important. Many of the American Indian and Alaska Native firms in this program are enterprises of their tribal nations. Native federal contracting is the second largest economic development driver in Indian country, according to the Native American Contractors Association. I spoke with Quentin Carroll, who is the executive director of the Native American Contractors Association and a tribal member of the Native Village of Barrow in Alaska, who described its contributions.
And the proceeds from those revenues are going back to tribal and Native communities to support infrastructure, public safety, education. And we're different in the sense that we're not a publicly traded company. We're not an individual entrepreneur.
Both Carol and Slotty said there haven't been any new tribal firms added to the 8A program since August.
You mentioned that there have been hundreds of Air Force contracts awarded to American Indian and Alaska Native firms for work in Ohio. How is this affecting businesses here in our region?
Locally, there is Dene Development Corporation, which opened an office in Dayton in 2024. It started in the 8A program about 20 years ago. It works in IT, cybersecurity, and cloud services. It's an enterprise of the Navajo Nation, the largest federally recognized tribal nation by enrollment. Austin Soce is the CEO of Dene Development, and he said that they've responded to all of the data calls for its subsidiaries in the program and haven't heard any bad news, but it's taking more work.
And the staff is definitely feeling the pressure and feeling overworked during this time. But, you know, I appreciate them for their efforts and, you know, all of the goodness that is, you know, still makes me very confident running DDC.
They also have a subsidiary that they've been trying to get certified since July of last year, but it's been a radio silence from the SBA on the decision.
So what has the administration done or said now?
I reached out to Wright-Patterson's public affairs office and they declined to comment. Carol says the Small Business Administration sent out internal guidance last year stating that programs supporting American Indian and Alaska Native tribes shouldn't be affected by executive orders targeting DEI programs. Carol says that really the contractors are waiting for some results or report to come out of some of those data calls that the businesses have responded to over the last year.
So we'll see where this goes. Adriana Martinez-Smiley, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Also in the national spotlight, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments next week challenging the Trump administration's attempts to terminate temporary protected status for Haiti and Syria. One of the plaintiffs is a Springfield resident, Viles Dorsonville. Since 2021, he's lived in our community under TPS. He founded the Haitian Support Center and serves as its executive director. Dorsonville is also an active Moravian pastor. WISO's Catherine Mobley spoke with him about his faith and how it's influencing his choice to participate in this national lawsuit.
I think that Moravian has always been for justice, for inclusivity. We are one family in Christ. The Moravian always stood against racial discrimination or mistreatment of people based on their skin color or their country of origin. And I think that through my training with the Moravian, that normally compels me to stand in solidarity with the most vulnerable group of people.
Viles, you've described Moravians as exercising a social biblical approach in their ministry and evangelism. What do you mean by that?
They would look to see what they should do in that particular area to serve the people. If there is no water, they would try to bring water. If there is no school, if there is no education, they would work on those first before building any church. There is no development. They would work on those first. So this is why when you go to a Moravian facility or a Moravian campus, you would see that the church is attached to other social things like school. And they believe in helping human beings to attain their potentials. And this is how they see bringing folks to Christ through social work.
You were trained in Jamaica and then returned to Haiti as a missionary. What were your duties?
I'm a young pastor. I went back home. My responsibility was to help churches to develop socialism. So by implementing good administration, good stewardship, helping the church buying location for themselves, help the young people to be self-aware of who they are and their potentials.
In 2018, you left your family and home in Haiti. Why?
The hoodlums believe that I came back with money. And it's the money I came back with that I am doing all this type of job. They were financed by specifically the Moravian Church worldwide, or the Unity, as they call it, or get sponsorship from other organizations. The hoodlums send you letters asking you for money that you don't have. When you see that happens, you will be subject to kidnapping. So you have to make a choice. And when my mother believed that I would be a target for kidnapping and suggested that I leave for my safety.
In 2021, you came to the United States on temporary protected status and settled in Springfield because you had a nephew who lived there. Early on, you say you witnessed other TPS holding Haitian immigrants being taken advantage of, which ultimately motivated you to create the Haitian Support Center. Describe some of those situations.
I used to work in factories. I used to work in other places. It was painful to see a person work 7 days a week without resting. And they used to give them a debit card where they pay them on that card. You would see that person coming to next day to say that they went to an ATM with a card. They don't get anything on it. They give it to somebody to activate the card for them, but all of a sudden the money just gone. I witnessed folks in Springfield. They would need a ride to go to the laundromat, and another person would come and have them pay a huge amount of money and make them believe that the laundromat is so far. And when the person is getting used to the community, they realize that the laundromat was just around the corner. There should be somebody that keeps those folks accountable. And this was the purpose of Haitian Support Center, a place where those vulnerable group of people can come and get some services without any hesitation that something will happen to them.
Vilas, I've interviewed several Haitians in Springfield who are in the United States on TPS just like you. Most of them say they want to return home to Haiti. Do you believe it's safe for people to go back?
Returning home is the desire, but no. The hoodlums are still in operation in Port-au-Prince. They kidnap folks in Haiti for various reasons, and sometimes for no reason at all. And folks are still living where they do not have any access to clean water, medication, or food. And the government is incapable to help people to meet those needs.
On April 29th, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear a lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's attempt to terminate temporary protected status for Haiti and Syria. You intend to be in the audience. Why?
Be there as a community leader.
There is a metaphor they use for Haitian. We are a reed. All instability, the natural disasters, all the shootings in Haiti, the kidnappings. You would believe that would break us? Now we are being folded to give the storm time to pass, and after we rise again. They call Haitian the people who dare to live. When you dare to live, it's, life does not like you. For some reason, you've been through a lot, but you dare to live.
Vilas Dorsonville, Executive Director of the Haitian Support Center in Springfield. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. We've got Bird Note coming your way. Up first, access to gender-affirming care in the U.S. often comes down to where you live and the laws that are in place. That patchwork can have serious consequences. In today's episode of Translucent, Lee Wade talks with a physician about what happens when care is interrupted or denied and why starting and stopping treatment can do real harm.
Across the country, laws and policies governing medical care for transgender youth vary state by state and can change quickly, leaving families, doctors, and young people navigating uncertainty alongside deeply personal decisions. Meredith McNamara is a physician at the Yale School of Medicine who specializes in adolescent medicine and teaches pediatrics. She is also a prominent advocate for on-demand access to medical gender transition services for youth in the United States.
We know that when people who experience gender incongruence, the difference between their physical bodies and their sense of self, achieve physical attributes that help them feel like themselves and feel better about their bodies, that other mental health benefits ensue. Gender is a really important, deeply held sense of who we are, whether we're male or female or something else. So medications like estrogen and testosterone and other types of medications along those lines can be really helpful to trans and gender diverse people for achieving those physical characteristics that they desire.
While some lawmakers label gender-affirming care experimental, McNamara says the real question is what happens when people are prevented from accessing it.
The real experimental care that's going on for trans and gender diverse people right now is the systematic deprivation of their care in settings where institutions, clinics are suddenly deciding to stop We're talking about people who will suffer and do suffer when their care is forcibly withdrawn. We don't know how to take care of somebody who desires and qualifies for gender-affirming medications, is actively receiving them, and then must be stopped, right? That is experimental.
At the center of it all are young trans people, and McNamara shared one story that stayed with her.
I had a patient a couple of years ago who was able to receive testosterone because, you know, he was in the foster care system. And finally, after all of these appeals and all of these kind of like medical reviews of his case, the state consented to care on his behalf. And it was the first time he ever felt, you know, seen, heard, and valid. And that, you know, spilled over into school, into future orientation. He's like, well, maybe I can go to college now because I feel like I know what my life could be like in 5 years' time. Everybody benefits from that sort of perspective. But when that perspective unfolds and blooms in adolescence, it's just so extraordinary to see.
But some lawmakers are pushing to restrict this care. And McNamara says many of them don't fully understand what the treatment actually involves.
From top down, and I really mean starting at the top, recognize that this is medically necessary care, that it cannot be safely stopped. And if you would not safely stop any other type of healthcare that you offer, don't do it for this. What I would say to policymakers is, I don't think you really belong in this space if you don't understand this care. What's real is that trans identity exists, that people benefit when they receive affirming medical care, should they desire it, should they qualify for it, and that this is care that people continue and incorporate into their lives.
Thank you, Meredith McNamara, for the amazing work that you're doing to advance understanding of gender-affirming care.
And a big thank you to producing an informationally sound medium for people to obtain information. That's a really brave and important thing to do right now. And I know that this takes time. So you're doing amazing work too.
I'm Lee Wade, and thank you for listening to Translucent.
Translucent is supported by the Ruby Girls Foundation and Square One Salon and Spa, and produced right here at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSL.
This is Bird Note. In spring, millions of songbirds migrate north across the Gulf of Mexico from the Yucatan to the southeastern U.S. One author describes this crossing as one of the greatest crapshoots in bird migration. When the weather is fair and tailwinds strong, the flight, while metabolically taxing, is completed quite handily. But when birds encounter rainstorms or headwinds, they struggle mightily, and many may die. After fighting sustained bad weather, birds reaching the U.S. coast are exhausted and famished. They drop into the nearest shrubs and trees by the thousands. Picture a shrub loaded with colorful tanagers and orioles, such as these orchard orioles. Or a tree full of brilliant warblers. These are Tennessee warblers. But why risk exhaustion or a watery demise when birds could instead migrate north along the length of Mexico? It's likely that many birds evolved to take the potentially perilous Transgulf route because it is direct and considerably faster. The Transgulf flight saves nearly a week of travel time, putting birds on the best breeding territories more quickly and thus increasing their chances of raising more young. Find more about Transgulf migration at birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
BirdNote wrapping up this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Our series is also available wherever you download and subscribe to your podcasts. Our theme music is provided by Magnolia Bolthead, a nice tune called Another Beautiful Day in Paradise. And we hope you're having a beautiful weekend here in the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. We've got more highlights and conversations for you next weekend. Please join us then.